talk about here is motivated from the general question whether an information theoretic perspective can be used to tell us something deeper about the architecture of physical theories. So information theory, of course, has given us a lot of tools and applications in many areas of physics and has had a great success. So, but apart from those successes, I want to ask here whether we can even use information theoretic ingredients to define theories or to derive theories. So the basic idea being that if we take an operational approach, that the mere possibility or impossibility of certain information theoretic tasks, that should be deeply intertwined with the structure of the theory that we're trying to understand. And so that's what I want to do here in this talk. I want to talk about an observer acquiring information about some system, and then I want to show how simple rules of that govern this information acquisition lead to quantum theory. So what we're going to be dealing with is therefore a reconstruction of quantum theory. So first of all, what is a reconstruction of quantum theory? So we were trying to derive the formalism of the theory from some set of physical postulates. So, but there are a few steps, of course, required to do that. Just like if one tries to derive relativity, special relativity, or general relativity from some postulates, then one needs to presuppose some physical or mathematical structure. We also need to do that here. So we first of all need to define some sort of landscape of theories that hopefully contains quantum theory, and which gives us some also mathematical meaning to axioms that we can formulate that hopefully single out quantum theory from within that landscape. So we can then ask what makes quantum theory special within that landscape. And then the third step would be to derive the formalism of quantum theory, for instance, what the possible state spaces, time evolution groups, and so on are. So of course, one can ask the question, why would I want to do this in the first place? We have a very beautiful theory that works very well. But yeah, one motivation is that it can help us to give some operational sense to the usual textbook's axiom of quantum theory, which of course are mathematically nice, but physically somewhat obscure. So only by going beyond the usual Hilbert space formulations, we can ask why or what makes quantum theory special and why we should use Hilbert spaces, tensor product rules, complex numbers, unitaries, and so on. Another motivation is that possibly by taking a new perspective on quantum theory, maybe we get some new structural insights into the theory that otherwise we would miss. Then another motivation can be or is that by actually understanding quantum theory within a larger landscape that gives us a systematic handle on generalizing the theory. So that helps us to understand quantum theory within a larger context. And for instance, also in light of the attempt to derive or to construct more fundamental theories, whether quantum theory as we have it should be a fundamental theory or not, whether all the physical statements that single it out should be acceptable or not. And then another hope has been voiced a few times, namely that once we have a reconstruction of quantum theory from physical statements, that would finally help us interpret or give us a correct interpretation of the theory, although one could probably claim that this hope has thus far not been realized despite there already existing some reconstructions of quantum theory. So so there already exist a number of reconstructions, most of which have been formulated in the landscape of so-called generalized probability theories. So it was in fact kick-started by Lucien here, and then culminated in the beautiful works of, for instance, Luis Massanes and Markus Müller that some of you may have heard about also in a colloquium in last year. So the basic idea here is very simple. It's a very operational approach to quantum theory. So one talks about preparation devices that can spit out some systems. You can do some transformations on these systems and then some measurements. I don't want to go into too much detail here, but so you can then also formulate very operational axioms that restrict what sort of states are or state spaces are possible, what sort of transformations are allowed, and measurements, and so on. And there are quite nice works in this direction. And in fact, they all emphasize the probabilistic structure of the theory. So, but here I want to actually take a slightly different viewpoint on reconstructing quantum theory. And that is motivated by some work or some developments that have taken place in parallel to these reconstructions. The general view being by trying to understand or interpret the theory as being really a framework that describes an observer's acquisition of information about a system. And here, what I basically want to do is take a step back and ask whether we can derive quantum theory from that perspective. And that will, in my opinion, give us a new perspective on the theory. Well, to emphasize information acquisition. In fact, this is also close more to the relational interpretation of quantum mechanics, although I won't talk too much about this because I don't want to talk too much about interpretational issues here. It will give very simple axioms between concerning the relation between an observer and the system. And as I will try to convince you, the derivation of quantum theory will be relatively constructive, giving very explicitly the structure of the theory. Then what I should say, there's also a slight disadvantage to it. So what I'm going to talk about now is more like a proof of principle that this ansatz works. But I will have to make some assumptions also in the landscape that probably in some sense make this landscape smaller than the landscape usually in GPTs. So mathematically in that sense it may be somewhat weaker reconstruction, but it will nevertheless be non-trivial. So that's the general schema which we want to work. So here's the outline for the remainder. I first of all want to briefly summarize the landscape or the new landscape of theories from within which I want to reconstruct quantum theory and what the tools are generally. Then I will tell you what the postulates are to derive the theory from within that landscape. I'll tell you more or less what the strategy is to derive it. Then I summarize roughly the reconstruction steps, and then I finish with brief conclusions. Okay, so this is the overall setup that we want to consider. So the focus here shall be really the information, as I said already, the information acquisition of an observer about a system. And in fact, this is also a perspective that Rob has had in his derivation of this toy model. But here I want to take an additional premise, and that is we only want to talk about the information that an observer has access to by interaction with the system. And I don't want to make any ontic statements, so it should be a purely epistemic approach. So the setup will be as follows here. So as in GPTs, I will also consider that there's some preparation method, but I will not consider now transformations and measurements in the GPT sense, but more generally, I will talk about time evolution, and then the measurement is replaced by interrogation of some system or some ensemble of systems by an observer with questions. And these questions are supposed to be only binary here, so only yes or no questions. So this will ultimately give a restriction and we only get qubit quantum theory, but that's at least something. So, and the basic ingredients here shall be, or mathematical ingredients is Q, that is the set of binary questions that the observer is allowed to ask the system. So for instance, these binary questions, there could be something in for a qubit, for instance, a spin 1/2 particle, like is the spin up in X direction, yes or no, something like this. So I will not make any specific assumptions on the structure of Q at this moment. That will be the task to figure out what that is in the end. And then we'll assume that with this preparation device, that there exist different methods of preparation, that every method of preparation will give a particular set of statistics over the answers that to the questions that the observer can ask the systems if he's asking a whole ensemble of systems and the number of systems in it is very, very large. So, and sigma is then supposed to be the set of all possible answer statistics that are possible for this, for such a device. So ultimately the sigma will be the state space. So and then I will have to make an assumption here, and I will simply assume that that O has tested sufficiently many times, sufficiently many identically prepared systems to know what this set sigma is. So he has a theoretical model of what this set sigma is. So this is the general setup. So now I want to introduce a bit more structure on it. So first of all, what I should say is, so we will take a somewhat Bayesian viewpoint on probabilities. So we'll imagine that the observer is some sort of agent who can write down the answers to the questions that he's asking the systems, and he can do statistics over them. And he will assign or be able to assign probabilities to the outcomes of questions to systems that he will interrogate according to the information that he has already about the set of all possibilities, what the answers to statistics are, and also according to his prior information about a particular system. So for instance, he can have interrogated a whole bunch of identically prepared systems that already give him some prior information about you know, the next system that he will want to interrogate. So and he will, based on basically the frequency of outcomes of the questions that he asked the previous identically prepared systems, based on those frequencies, he will assign probabilities to the outcomes of the questions of the next system that he will ask. So for instance, if you always, for all the systems that he asked before, he would always get a yes answer to a particular question, then he would assign to his, according to his belief, degree of belief, that the probability is one that the next system will also give a yes answer to that question. So then these probabilities, so they encode everything that the observer can know about the system. So you can only acquire information by asking questions. So and then therefore I will define the state of the system relative to that observer as being the collection of all these probabilities to all the questions that he can ask the system. So it's really a catalog of knowledge of the observer about the system. So it's really a state of information. And then basically the state space will be the set sigma of all possible answer statistics. And an analogy to the GPT framework, I will require this to be convex. So of course, the collection of all probabilities is a somewhat unhandy way of parameterizing states, but I will come back to this in a minute. So and then I need to introduce a bit more structure on this on the state space, or also to add a bit of structure on the set of questions that the observer is allowed to ask the system. For that, I will require that there exists a special state in the state spaces, which I call the state of information, which is such that all the that it gives probability 1/2 for all the questions that the observer may, binary questions that the observer may ask the system. So basically, this is a special way of preparing systems such that it will give random answers to all the questions that the observer can ask the system. So, and for instance, if the observer has no information about the system, that this will be the prior state that he will assign to the system, and when he will assign probabilities in a Bayesian updating. So, using this state of no information, I can now define the notion of independence of questions. And I define two questions to be independent or maximally independent if they're independent relative or stochastically independent relative to the state of no information. So basically, if the answer to only the question QI asked to the system, and then afterwards, if that answer does not give the observer any information about the question QJ if asked in sequence to the same system. So if the probability of both questions giving yes if asked in sequence relative to the state of no information, it factorizes and should give one quarter. So I should say that this notion of independence is a bit different from the notion of linear independence of Bloch vectors. So then I will assign or will define questions to be compatible if the observer may know both of these, the answers to both of these questions simultaneously. So I will meaning that there exist states in the state space such that the probabilities of these two questions can be simultaneously 0 and 1. And I will define questions to be complementary if the full information about the answer of one question will disallow the observer to know anything about the answer to the other question at the same time. So basically, if whenever one question has probability 0 or 1, that then for all states, the probability that the other question is known that will give you a yes answer is 1/2. So, yeah.
Am I right that compatibility and complementarity are really about measurements on a single copy of the system?
Yeah.
And independence, I should think of as a statement about measurements on an ensemble of systems. And am I right that it's not crucial that the measurements are done in sequence? I can imagine, say, doing QI on a subset of my ensemble and concluding that won't give me any information about what I would obtain.
No, so it should be in sequence on the same system. Because, for instance, if you have, if you think of a single qubit, and if you think of a question that corresponds to spin in x direction, and another question that would correspond to spin in some direction very close to it, they would not be independent according to that notion here. So because I'm asking, once I know the answer is yes, that the spin is up in x direction, then I would have a high probability that it will be yes as well in a very closely related direction.
So, for example, like if you take cases that are independent, like X and Z, not only is it true that you can't start getting predictability about Z after you've measured X on the same system, if I have an ensemble of similarly prepared systems, measuring X on a sub-ensemble doesn't teach me anything about what I'm going to get for Z.
But you see, so with what I just said is, if you took now relative to the state of no information, so if I ask now one system, you know, is it up in x direction? I get yes. And then I would say, okay, with a high probability, it will also be up in some closely related direction. But if I did ask the same question, now not to the same system, but to some other system before, which may be totally random, then I may get a, the probability would be 1/2 that that I get a yes answer. So that's why here it's really in sequence on the same system.
What do you presume about the nature of the update map of the first measurement? You need to say something like, in quantum mechanics, I assume you're, I think you have like a quantum learning collapse update.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, so actually, I mean, here I'm not really using the GPT framework, but I would then say that basically, for instance, for a qubit, the state that I would assign after I've asked, you know, is it up in x direction, then I get yes, then I would just assign that state to the system so that it's up. So it would be the so here one has to distinguish is really basically the ensemble state and the a posteriori state of, so basically what one has to distinguish here is single shot interrogation and multiple shot interrogation. So in a single shot interrogation, I will try to figure out what the system of that particular state is. What the state of that particular system is that I'm interrogating. And with a multiple shot interrogation, I would try to figure out what the state of the ensemble is. So in here, basically the answer that I get tells me what the state of the system is after I've interrogated it. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so now, so far so good. Now I will introduce a bit of additional structure. So because what I said before, if you now have the collection of all probabilities to all the possible questions that the observer is allowed to ask, is of course a bit of an unpractical way of parametrizing states. So I will now make an additional assumption. So basically the idea here is that now that we have a notion of independence, I want pairwise independence questions to be the fundamental building block of the theory that we're trying to construct here. And I will just assume that whenever you have a maximal set of pairwise independent questions, so you have a set Q1 to QD, and there exists no further question than the set of questions that that the observer can ask, which would also be independent of all the questions in here, that this would be informationally complete in the sense that it actually parametrizes the state so that it, so that the probabilities corresponding to these D questions, that they give you a full representation of the state. So in this sense, then we finally have a, so this vector here would then represent the state of the system, and that of course will simplify many, the whole discussion. So it's a bit related to some of the things that are also done in GPTs. So then since we're now taking an informational approach here, we also want to quantify the information that an observer has about a system that will become very important. So for the moment, I would just assume that whatever, so that the information that the observer has about a particular system, question QI, we will parameterize that by function alpha that shall only depend on the probability associated to that question. It shall be between 0 and 1 bits. And once we have that, we now define the total information that the observer has about the system as being just the sum of these informations or information measures corresponding to all the questions that are in this informationally complete set. So we really think of the observer as being an agent who can write down numbers on a piece of paper and add them up. So, but here I will not tell you what this alpha is. This is something that will follow later from the principles. So we don't want to assume a particular information measure. So then we were going to be dealing with a qubit system. So I should tell you what I mean actually by a composite system. And so here the sort of composite systems that I want to be working with, I define in the following sense. So I will say that a system SAB is composed of two systems SA and SB. If the question set that the observer is allowed to ask that system SAB is simply given by basically the two question sets that you can ask the subsystems, and if all the other questions are just given by logical connectives of questions in the first set and in the second set. So it's so the observer, because he can only acquire information about systems by questions, he should be able, in terms of the questions, to tell systems apart. And I will also assume it will be necessary that, for instance, all questions in QA and all questions in QB should be compatible. Otherwise, it would be difficult to talk about a composite system. So Okay, so far so good, but now I actually need to, there's two now somewhat strong assumptions that I need to impose on this landscape. Of course, any additional assumption weakens the reconstruction, but nevertheless, it will be non-trivial. So one assumption that I need to make is that Speckers principle holds. So that is the idea that if we have n pairwise compatible questions, that they shall also be mutually compatible. So at first sight, that may seem relatively innocent, but it is a relatively strong assumption. It's not even, I think, realized for generalized measurements in quantum theory. It's only true for projective measurements. I mean, it's true in classical theory, but anyway, so I will assume that this holds. And I will also require now this additional requirement that basically that the observer, so motivated from the fact that we only want to talk about information that the observer has access to by interrogation, I will disallow the observer to make any consistent statements about logical connectives of complementary questions. So if you have two complementary questions, then it shall be impossible for the observer to say, for instance, that they're correlated, despite the fact that he may not know what the individual answers to the individual questions would be. Okay, so this is as much as I want to tell you about the landscape of theory. So, and within that landscape, we now want to impose postulates that shall single out a qubit quantum theory. So these are postulates now for n qubits. The first postulate stipulates that there exists a limit of information that an observer, or how much information an observer can acquire about a system. And so basically, yeah, O can acquire maximally n independent bits of information about the system at any moment of time. And what do I mean by this in terms of the questions? There shall exist a maximum set of n mutually independent compatible questions in that question set that the observer may ask the system. So for instance, if you have a single qubit, then or a single spin 1/2 particle n equals 1, then you know once you know the answer to the spin in x direction, then at the same time, you're not allowed to know anything else about the system. But of course, in that case, you could always take a different question or a different measurement and ask them afterwards, what's the spin in y direction? And there's something that we also want to stipulate here, that there exists a notion of complementarity. So we'll, which I interpret in the following way, so that O can always get up to n new independent bits of information about the system. And whenever O asks a new question, he experiences no net loss of information. And what I mean by this in terms of the questions, that there exists another maximum set of n mutually independent and compatible questions, but which are pairwise, in fact, complementary with the questions of the first or with an, of the first postulate. So here I will only stipulate that there exists complementarity, take that as an empirical evidence, but I will not say how much complementarity there is. So for instance, of course, for a qubit, we have three mutually complementary or maximally complementary directions. I will not assume that there are three. I will only assume that there exists complementarity. So then, so these first two postulates, by the way, are motivated by work by Carlo Rovelli, Zeilinger, and Bruckner. But they're not quite enough to get quantum theory. So what the next postulate I call completeness, but you can also interpret this as a superposition principle. And basically, what I say here is that the information that the observer has about the system can be distributed in any way of all the questions that he can ask the system as long as it abides by the first two principles. So basically, any state is permissible such that it is compatible with the first two principles. Then there's a fourth postulate. This one I call preservation, and I require that the total amount of information that the observer has about the system is preserved in between interrogations. So by that, I mean, for instance, what I've defined before as being the total information of the observer, that this should be constant in time in between the interrogations. So basically, this also defines a notion of, or in this case, basically, this would be also understanding of the systems that he's interrogating are not interacting with any environment. Then there's a fifth postulate, and I will have to require that the time evolution of the state is continuous. That turns out to be quite important. So in fact, these five postulates, they basically do all the job. So these five postulates, they have two solutions. One is standard qubit quantum theory. The other solution is a real quantum theory. So it's two-level systems over real Hilbert spaces. So you get qubits and rebits from these postulates. And rebits, in fact, are just a subcase of qubits. You can even produce them in the lab. So basically, the two solutions that you get, they are physical. So you could be happy with this. But if you really wanted to get rid of rebits as well, of the real solution, then you have to impose another postulate, which is basically local tomography in GPTs, which is that the observer can determine the state of a composite system by only interrogating its constituents. This is, in fact, a postulate that is much stronger than just distinguishing between real and complex quantum theory. So that's why I'm not quite happy by imposing it. But at the moment, I don't actually know another good postulate that singles out or that distinguishes between the two. Okay, so then the claim would be that the state spaces would be the set of n-qubit density matrices for a given fixed n, that the states evolve unitarily, and that the questions that the observer may ask, that those particular systems, they correspond to Pauli operators. Although I should say that the last statement here, one needs to make an extra assumption to make that true. Okay, so I don't really have time, of course, to, you had a question? Or? Yeah, no, I'm not. So what I get here is.
Is the claim these axioms lead to sort of what, like one or even
yeah. Qubits? Yeah, so what I'm getting is basically projective measurements on Pauli operators. So it's not POVMs, what I'm having here, it's true. Yeah. Okay, so, so here's the strategy of how to derive quantum theory from these postulates. So first of all, one can combine the limited information postulate and the complementarity postulate. And using those, one can derive what the question and correlation structure is of the theory. You get entanglement, monogamy, and so on from these postulates already. Then you can combine the preservation of information and time evolution axiom that will give you reversible time evolution and, in fact, a quadratic information measure. Then you can combine these results, and using the completeness and locality axiom, you can show that then for a single qubit, the state space indeed is a Bloch ball, three-dimensional time evolution group is SO3. Then next step is you go to n equals 2. First of all, you have to derive the time evolution group, which is PSU4. You can derive it from these postulates. PSU4 is indeed what you have in quantum theory. The state space are the convex hull of CP3. That's the state of density matrices for two qubits. And then using all these results, you can combine them. And in fact, using also universality, you know, from quantum computation, you can combine these results to get it also for arbitrarily many qubits. So I will try to summarize some of these steps here. Of course, I cannot tell you all the, I cannot tell you all the individual steps, of course, but I will also, the way we will go through it now is, so first this, then this, then this, then this, and then that.
Yeah.
So basically the statement is that whenever, so that is supposed to hold in general, whenever the observer asks a new question, that afterwards, after asking a question, you cannot have less information about the system than before asking that question. So, and I need to impose that because that, that turns out to be necessary. So you could consider a system which would be totally stupid that, I don't know, you have a, okay, now I have to cook up something from the top of my head, but. Sorry. Invalid. Yeah. So basically, you would render some of the previous information obsolete. So you could cook up a stupid toy example where this would happen, and I couldn't rule out that this happens here in this case. That's why I imposed it. It turns out to be necessary in deriving the correct question structure. Yeah, but not. Yeah, but I mean, no, sure. But then afterwards, no. I mean, I'm talking about the total information. So of course, you render some of the information obsolete. But in the case when you first measure x, then let's say you have one bit of information about that direction, and then you measure it in y direction. Then you have a new bit of information, but you have lost what it was previously. But in total, you still have one bit, so you have not lost anything. So I mean that's a good point. So I mean you can So Specker's principle, for instance, one could put it in the set of postulates. That's possible. So the reason I didn't include it in the set of postulates is because the set of postulates really, they only talk kind of about the relation of the observer and the system, and Specker's principle is doesn't really fit into it, but one could include it there instead of the assumptions. So, but I mean, I totally agree that you could make that seventh postulate if you want to. Okay. So let's start with the question correlation structure. So first of all, let's consider the case that we have a single qubit. So all we know from the postulate so far is that we have a bunch of questions. I will denote them by vertices here. They must be mutually complementary. So sorry, what I'm trying to describe here is an informationally complete set. So we are trying to talk about pairwise independent questions. So all we know from the complementarity principle is that there must exist at least two complementary questions for a single qubit, but there could be more, of course. We don't know how much there are at the moment. So if we go to n equals two, so two qubits, then it's a composite system. For the other system, I will also have the individual questions, which I denote by vertices here. But now, as a composite system, we're also allowed to build composite questions by logical connectives. And so the question is, how can we now build logical connectives of these questions here in order to build up an informationally complete set of questions, which is pairwise independent? And then you can think about and convince yourself that so if you have two questions, QI, QJ, so one from system one, the other one system two, if you want to build a composite system composite question that is supposed to be independent of the previous one, then the logical connective has to be of this form here. So A is different from B, and the only solution that you get up to negation is unique. So you get either that the logical connective is the XNOR in the case when B is one, or the XOR in the case when A is one. So for instance, if you had an AND operation, then that wouldn't give you a question that would always be pairwise independent. So that means the composite questions we will always build up with one of the either XNOR or XOR. Of course, physically that would be identical, and we can just make a convention here. And henceforth, I will make the convention that we choose the XNOR to build up composite questions. The XNOR I will denote by this double arrow there. So we can do this now. So for instance, if we have Q1 and Q1 prime, I will denote the composite question by Q11 and denote it by an edge. And it corresponds to the question, the XNOR, it really corresponds to the question, are the answers to Q1 and Q1 prime correlated? And the XOR would be, are they anti-correlated? Of course, we can now get these composite questions between any two questions between the left and right-hand side, because they're compatible. And then you can actually use these the postulates to show that these composite questions, in fact, they are pairwise independent. You can show that. You can also show that they're complementary if the corresponding edges intersect in a vertex. So for instance, Q11 and Q31, they intersect here in this vertex. Means they are complementary, and you can understand why, because if the observer knew, for instance, that these two are correlated and that these two are also correlated, then you would know that these two complementary questions are correlated, which is illegal. And you can also show, in fact, that if you now have two composite questions that do not intersect, like Q11 and Q22, they must be compatible. And that has very strong repercussions, because that immediately implies entanglement. Because remember that we're now considering an n equals two system, oops, and that means the observer can acquire only up to two independent bits of information about the system. And for instance, Q11 and Q22 are pairwise independent, they're compatible. That means the observer can spend his entire information that he can acquire about the system over composite questions. So he will have zero information about the individual properties of the systems, and will only have composite information. So that, in fact, these question combinations will ultimately also correspond to Bell states. So you can basically define then entanglement as being the case when you have more than one bit of information in composite questions. That corresponds also to the definition that that Zeilinger and Bruckner once gave many years back. So I don't want to talk too much about this anymore. So now, next question I want to ask is, so what's the dimension now of these systems? So what is D1? So how many complementary questions do we have for a single system? Turns out that you need to consider pairs of qubits to answer that question. So what I told you before is that composite questions are, first of all, pairwise independent, and they're compatible if they do not intersect. So for instance, we could take these diagonal questions here. They do not intersect, but they're all compatible. So it means the observer, by using Speckle's principle, if they're pairwise compatible, then they're mutually compatible. So that means the observer can ask all of these systems at, questions at the same time and acquire the answers to all of these questions at the same time. But then we have to remember that there's a limit on the information, that the independent information that the observer can acquire about the system. Maybe we can only know maximally 2 bits, independent bits of information. That means the system, these questions, despite being pairwise independent, they cannot be mutually independent. And that, then you can ask the question, for instance, suppose the observer has first asked Q11 and Q22, that basically should determine the answers to all of the other questions. And then you can ask, how would that be possible? How could Q33 be determined, for instance, from Q11 and Q22? And in such a way that afterwards it is also still pairwise independent. And then again, like before, you will find that it's up to negation, either the XOR or the XNOR. So it means Q33 would have to be determined, would have to be either the correlation of these questions or the anti-correlation. But that means there cannot exist more than, there cannot exist more than 3 complementary questions individually, because for Q44, the same argument would hold. And then, but then Q44 and Q33 would no longer be independent, because the way you determine them from Q, from the first 2 questions, would up to negation be the same. Then you can repeat the argument for any other pair, set of compatible questions, and you would always find the same answer. And that means that the dimensionality of the individual system is at most 3 and at least 2. So that's so basically that's where you get the 2 solutions, that you get rebits and qubits. So qubits have 3, rebits have 2. And I will not show that here, but you can also do the degree of freedom counting. For D1 equals 3, you get 15 questions. For n equals 2, that's the correct number for qubits. And for D1, you would get 9. That's the correct number for rebits. So now I want to talk a bit more about the correlation structure. So we have now determined that Q33 is one of these 2. So that's we use basically this argument that Q33 is up to negation, the correlation of these 2. But we could have done the same argument now with this set of 3 questions here. We use this cross here. So we could do the same, and then we would find that Q33 is up to negation, also the correlation of these 2. And then using the first, using these equations, we would have to conclude that either this equation is true or that equation here. So either there's no relative negation or there is a relative negation. And so it turns out that, okay, it looks quite innocent, but the consequences are quite deep. You see, so basically the idea here is that, so suppose case A was true, that Q11, and then let's take the case where Q11 and Q22 are 1. This would imply that these 2 are correlated. You could, in this case, basically consistently join those graphs in such a way that you talk consistently about the simultaneous values of the questions corresponding to these edges, and also consistently about values that the individual questions take. And in this way, in fact, the observer could conclude that in this case, for instance, the complementary questions are, you can talk consistently about the correlations of complementary questions, but that's something that I will forbid. So there's something, basically what you get here is, this is the classical logic case, or the logic of local hidden variables. And I will not allow this. So, and then it turns out that if you now consider the second case with a relative negation here, turns out that if you consider the same situation, you get 2 graphs. If you try to mix these graphs, you get a frustrated graph. And that means it's basically impossible to mix them together. And in this case, it would not be possible for the observer to make any consistent statements about correlations, for instance, of complementary questions. So, and this is then what we will conclude, that in our setup, this equation should be correct. Which one again? The back one.
In the green at the bottom. So you said that those 2 statements are complementary. I'm just wondering, how does that follow from the complementarity of?
No, I mean the Q1 and Q2 would. So I mean, so these two are complementary. So that I already know from before.
Right.
And then these two are complementary, but basically by considering the situation, you would have to conclude that you could conclude that the that you have a meaningful correlation between these complementary questions, and that this correlation would be the same as that.
No, I have that. I'm asking a more basic question, which is just, it seems like you're appealing to something like if Q1 is complementary to Q2, and Q1 is complementary to Q1 prime, and Q2 is complementary to Q2 prime, then any logical connectives of Q1 and Q2 will be complementary to the corresponding logical connective of Q1 prime and Q2 prime.
So. Sorry, actually, I'm not sure I totally understood your question, but so here the case is that Q1 and Q2 are actually complementary.
Oh, right, Q1 and Q2 are complementary.
Yeah. So, I mean, Q1 and Q2 are both compatible with these two. So, I mean, Q1 and Q2 are both compatible with both these
right.
questions.
Okay.
But this is complementary to that, and this is complementary to that. So basically, so if you have this situation here, you would always be able to. So basically, if you make the assumption now, okay, suppose I don't know what the individual values of these questions are, but suppose there are some, then you would always make this conclusion here that suppose these had local values, then you would always end up with this conclusion here that this is true. And then in this sense, I would always be able to make consistent statements about correlations of complementary questions. So basically here, the statement would be any such configuration could be interpreted in terms of a hidden variable model. And any hidden local hidden variable model would give you this correlation there. So in any such case, I would always be able to make conclusions, although the observer would not be able to know what these the values of these individual variables are, and also he would not know what the value of this correlation is, but he would be able to make a statement about correlations of complementary questions.
And that's somehow violated.
Yeah. So before I made this requirement that I don't allow the observer to make any consistent statements about logical connectives of complementary questions. And so here, he could always do it. And here, in this case, B, he cannot do it. So because here you get a frustrated graph, you can basically, it's impossible to mix these two graphs. So that's why we conclude that this must be true. So that has quite some consequences. So then, using similar tricks, you have to do a bit more work than what I'm telling you here. But using similar tricks, you can then derive, in fact, the correlation structure of quantum theory. So, and it, I find it nice to represent it in terms of this triangular tiling here. So now I've replaced the labels 1, 2, 3 by X, Y, Z to make it more suggestive of quantum theory. So the result is that is this graph, basically. So if questions here are connected by an edge, that means they're compatible. If they're not connected by an edge, it means they're complementary. And if three questions share a red triangle like this, then it means they're related by odd correlation. That means, for instance, the question A would be identical to the anti-correlation of B and C. And if they share a green triangle, then, for instance, question A would be given by the correlation of B and C, and that would hold also in permutations. So for instance, what this means is that consider QZZ being the correlation of the spins, for instance, in Z direction. So for instance, this here would mean that suppose the spins are correlated in X direction and they're also correlated in Y direction, that would mean they must be anti-correlated in Z direction, and that's also exactly what you get in quantum theory. And then here, for instance, that we get a plus here and a minus here is exactly due to this relative negation here, that gives you, because remember here, this gives you Q33, Q33 will be QZZ, and this relative negation here is then reflected in the fact that we get a minus and a plus here. So, Yeah, okay, I see I'm running out of time, so let me go ahead. So let me now briefly talk about the information measure. So first of all, recall that a state is now parametrized by the probabilities associated to an informationally complete set of questions. So we have now a d-dimensional probability vector. And now we want to impose, for instance, the preservation of information postulate and the time evolution postulate. And I will just tell you what the results are, not how you get it. So it basically implies that you get a reversible time evolution. The time evolution is some matrix that is part of some one-parameter group. And it acts linearly on the Bloch vector, where the Bloch vector is just, or it's a generalized Bloch vector, which is twice the state vector minus a vector full of ones. So and how you get this is, in fact, similar to the way you get linear transformations and GPTs. So it's similar to the argument that Lucene once came up with, or I think also Jonathan Barrett in one of his papers. So it's not exactly the same argument, but it's similar. So then, but once you have that, then you can also, in fact, determine what the information measure is that quantifies the information that the observer has about a particular question and about the whole system. And it turns out what you get is that this function alpha I is just this quadratic relation here. So it's the square of the Bloch vector component. And then the total information the observer about the system is just the square norm of the Bloch vector. Yes. No, I introduced them before. I think you missed that.
I did miss it, I'm sure. But I mean, the first time place in which they were used.
Ah, so in the reconstruction year.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so I mean, actually, in the, yeah, where I explicitly use them, yes, that's true. So I mean, and to get the correlation structure and compatibility and independent structure and so on of the question, you don't really need the probabilities. No. Yeah, so basically how far I get is that I can derive the full, for arbitrarily many qubits, the full question structure. That's the point. I don't get the, without talking about probabilities, I won't be able to talk about a continuity of the Bloch sphere.
So in what form do you get the Bloch sphere?
We'll get to that.
I mean, before, up to now,
I don't have a Bloch sphere. So on the next slide, I will explain how you will get to it. So, but anyway, so it turns out that the measure you get is really a square norm of the Bloch vector. And in fact, this proposal has been made similar from a slightly different perspective also by Buchner and Zeilinger before, but it matches very well with this derivation here. So, but then using this result, we can already read off more information, because now remember that the total information by the preservation axiom is supposed to be constant in between interrogations. So it really is a conserved charge of time evolution. That's a perspective that will be quite important soon. But then because it is a conserved charge, then we can consider what is the set of all possible time evolutions that preserves this. And well, that means the set of all possible time evolutions should be a subgroup of SODN, because, well, the SODN will definitely preserve this and it's connected to the identity. But it will turn out, of course, that in general you get a subgroup. So now I want to summarize how you can derive the state spaces and so on. So first step is consider a single qubit in the Bloch ball. So before I mentioned that you get for a qubit at d1 equals 3. So we have a three-dimensional state vector. What I forgot to say is, so I've implicitly already imposed the locality axiom to rule out rebit theory. In fact, you can do the whole reconstruction in the same way also for rebits, but I won't talk about it here. So, but now that we have the state vector, three-dimensional state vector, and we have an information measure, we can now start talking about pure states, mixed states, and completely mixed states. So pure states are simply all those states of maximal length, because the length of the Bloch vector is the information of the observer about the system. Here it's a one-bit system, so we're talking maximal length being basically one bit, or it's just one. Then mixed states are those that have less than one bit but more than zero, and the completely mixed state will be the one that has zero bits. And now I will invoke the completeness axiom that says that you can that any state is allowed that abides by the complementarity and the limited information principle. What you then basically get is just the Bloch ball as a solution with the totally mixed state in the center, pure states the boundary and so on. And then also the set of all possible time evolutions in this case will simply be SO3, a symmetry of the sphere. And in fact, under the condition that, you know, say that if every state, every pure state should correspond, of course, to an a fully answered question, given that it carries one bit. If you make that identification, then you get also that the set of questions that the observer can ask the system is also isomorphic to a sphere. So now let's come to the less trivial case. This is now 2 qubits. In fact, this result I find quite beautiful. So let me try to explain how you get to the state spaces for 2 qubits. Quite non-trivial. So first of all, from before, I mentioned that you get a 15-dimensional informationally complete set. So you have a 15-dimensional state vector. And using basically the complementarity and compatibility relations that I very briefly introduced before, you can convince yourself that you can group up the 15 questions into 6 maximal mutually complementary sets of questions, each containing 5 questions. And you can group them up in such a pentagon structure. So what it means here is that in such a pentagon, all these 5 questions in here, they're mutually complementary, and there exists no question in the set, in this total set of 15 questions that would also be complementary to all 5 in that set. So in that sense, it is maximal. So and then, okay, you can represent this in terms of this lattice structure. It turns out that any 2 pentagons overlap in exactly 1 question, and any question of these 15 questions is the overlap of 2 pentagons. And then, okay, you can say, okay, that's very nice that you can represent it as such a beautiful tiling here, but is that of any use? And in fact, it is of use, because what you can show is that for pure states, so here pure states are states of maximal information again, that they are such that each of these 6 pentagons carries exactly 1 bit of information. So it means, for instance, if you consider pentagon 1, then that means the information that's contained in it. So here in terms of this, so it's the information measure, the square of the Bloch vector components corresponding to those 5 questions must be exactly 1 for pure states. That holds for all pure states and holds for all of these 6 pentagons. So it means this gives us now more conserved charges than just the total information, which must be preserved. There are now additional conserved charges here. And so basically, that already will help us now to determine what the time evolution group is, because the time evolution group will have to preserve this, given that the time evolution group will have to map pure states to pure states. And hence, it must always satisfy these relations. So and then you can ask what sort of transformations would be possible that preserve it. So you can convince yourself quite easily that there exists no transformations other than the identity that would act only on a single pentagon and leave everything else invariant that would preserve all the pentagon ecologies. But there does exist now a transformation that will act on 2 pentagons and leave everything invariant. And that's, for instance, one example is the following that I have represented here in terms of these red arrows. Can consider pentagon 1 and 2 and simply swap the information between pentagon 1 and 2, completely exchange it in the sense in which it is given here. You swap the information in here with the information here, 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 and so on. You can easily convince yourself that that preserves all the pentagon equalities, because first of all, these 2 pentagons 1 and 2, they're just exchanged, so that certainly doesn't violate those equalities. But then you also see this information here swapped within this other pentagon. So it means it stays in that pentagon, so it is preserved. Same here, and in fact, the same here, because, for instance, this question QXY is also in this pentagon. So it turns out all of these swaps, they occur within pentagons. So it means all of these, after you carry out these full swaps of information, all of these conserved charges are still preserved. So and then, so you can do this, of course, for any of these overlaps of these 6 pentagons. So you can do it for any question being overlapping. So you get 15 such information swaps. And then at the level of the Bloch vector, this will define you a generator. And then, so here now I'm skipping a number of steps, but if you require that whatever the generator does should be compatible with the correlation structure that I showed you before in terms of these triangles, then you can show that it necessarily must be of this form here. So, and you can do that similarly for these other information swaps. And then you can stuff these 15 generators. So you get 15 such swap generators. Then you can stuff that into Mathematica, and then you can convince yourself that these 15 generators actually satisfy the Lie algebra of SU4, SO6, and PSU4. So now, then the question is, okay, now if we want to exponentiate them, in fact, you can do that. So, but if you exponentiate them, then the question is, do we get SU4? But that's a double cover of SO6, and SO6 is a double cover of PSU4. But you can. But it turns out that the exponentiation of these generators will give you a faithful representation of PSU4, and that is related to the fact that what the representation that we will get here is centerless. And then there's another important result. You can show that PSU4 is the maximal subgroup of SO15. But we know already that the time evolution group must be a subgroup of SO15, but it can, in fact, for two qubits, one can convince oneself it cannot be SO15 itself, because SO15 would map you from anywhere on a 14-dimensional sphere to anywhere else on the sphere, and there will exist states that are illegal. So basically, where you would have one question that carries all information of several bits. So it cannot be SO15, but we know a PSU4 is allowed, and since it's the maximum subgroup, there cannot be any other subgroup of SO15 in between. So we conclude from this that the set of all possible time evolutions is exactly PSU4, and that's precisely what you have in quantum theory. So then it turns out the pure states you can actually now define in terms of equalities, so pure Bloch vector states. So they are now defined by 21 partially dependent equalities. So first of all, we now know the pentagon equality, so such that every pentagon carries exactly one bit of information. But then there's 15 more what we can call pentagon preservation conditions. So these are conditions that you would get if you were linearizing, or basically if you require that before transformation, after transformation, that these equalities are satisfied. Turns out there will be six, in principle, 15 non-trivial relations. Of course, you have now 21 equations for 15 unknown. One could be worried that this is over-constrained, but it turns out it is not. So there's usually, there will be some relations between these equations, although we haven't figured out exactly what that relation, those relations are, but it turns out not to be necessary, because what you can show is once you start with a solution to these 21 equations and there exist solutions, you will always be mapped to a solution. And in fact, the solution that you will get, you can show that, so what you get basically is CP3. And that's the, in fact, you get two copies of CP3. It's related to the fact that these information measures, they cannot distinguish between whether we chose the XNOR or the XOR to build up composite questions, but they're physically equivalent. And then, okay, if you now want to have a convex space, then you just take the convex hull of it, and that's then the state of the full state space for two qubits. So the upshot here is that we get the unitary group and the states from complementarity relations and conserved informational charges. So let me be very brief on how we can go on now for arbitrary n. So first of all, you would have to define what a, or construct an informationally complete set of questions for n qubits. And you can show that they're given, or that this set here of questions, in fact, is informationally complete. It's logically closed under the XNOR, so you get basically all XNOR combinations of individual questions of n qubits, where here I take now four indices and zero index just means it's one. So and there are exactly four to the n minus one questions. That's the correct number that you have in of degrees of freedom for quantum theory for n qubits. You can also determine what the compatibility and complementarity structure is, but I won't go into that. So now, so we have the correct number of degrees of freedom, but then the next thing is then how do we get to the time evolution group? And here we will just take, we will just require that because we are dealing with composite systems, that any pair of qubits in that set of n qubits should be able to evolve independently of all the others according to simply a qubit pair. And then we can make use of some results from quantum computation where you have universality results that basically tell you that pairwise unitaries generate all unitaries for n qubits. Then you can also show, so that basically gives you a full unitary group for two qubits. You can also show again that this is a maximum subgroup of you know, whatever SO blah, blah, blah it is, to which we would conclude that this is the correct time evolution group. And then in a similar way to before, from you would get from this also the state space as being the convex hull of the CP, the complex projective space with according dimension. And in a similar way, one can also show that the under certain assumptions, also the set of all the questions corresponds to n qubit poly operators. So let me just conclude. So one can derive quantum theory from simple rules on information acquisition of an observer about a system. And this approach, at least in my opinion, gives a novel perspective on the dimensionality of state spaces in quantum theory. It elucidates the origin of entanglement and gives you an explanation for the intercorrelation structure. You can also get monogamy from this. I haven't actually talked about it. Then you get a novel way of quantifying the information of the observer about the system. And new insights in the origin of the unitary group and state space from complementarity relations and conserved charges. Yeah, so let me finish here. Thank you. That's the projective special unitary group. Basically in quantum theory, if you have an n by n, in this case you should have a for two n by two n density matrix for qubits, the time evolution would map you to u rho, blah blah blah. U dagger, where U for time evolution would be in SU4. And then the time evolution here, so it's the joint action. So that's you get a projective representation of SU4. So it's a representation up to phase on the densities.
Is there any difference between
PSU4
and PU4? Is that such a thing?
Yeah, I think there's also PU4. So basically in this case, so here you would, so PU4 would be what you would get from this when you don't use unitaries as being in the special unitary group, but in just in the U4.
Why does it have to be special?
Yeah, so I mean for time evolution, so time evolution, but time evolution should be connected to the identity. So I mean time evolution should be a connected path in your group. So it's a one parameter group in a set of unitaries. That's why I restrict it to SU4.
Your phase is a one parameter.
I can take any generators from SU4 and then take linear combination of them and then, what? Of course it does.
Just a small technical point. I'm just trying to understand what would be the distinction.
Between what? Yeah, I mean, it would basically be, what you would get for PU4 is if you take a joint action of U4 instead of SU4. That would give you a projective representation of that.
Is that the same thing?
is that the same for?
If I put a pure phase for U.
Yeah. Maybe that is true if you have, actually, maybe right that in this case it is probably true that maybe the same because the negative determinant would be, you have it twice, so it should be the same as if you took plus, I guess. Yeah, maybe it's actually the same in this case. I'm not quite sure about that. But in any case, I'm motivated from being connected to the identity, so I'll take SU4.
GPT approach hasn't really done much there. Is there anything you can say from this point of view?
Well, I mean, so I think it is close to, you can interpret it in the relational interpretation of Carlo Rovelli that you really think of the state as being a state of information of the observer about a system and all properties of the system are defined relative to the observer. I mean, because I'm only talking about the relation between observer and system here. Without making ontic statements or, so you can interpret it in this way. Of course, you don't necessarily have to, but I would say it's close to it, it adheres to it, But of course, with interpretations, you can always do many things. So if you wanted, you can also, of course, since it's quantum theory, you can always find some hidden variable model that will give you the same. But at least in this language, it would seem unnecessary to do that because, you know, I can live without it. So that's why I would say it's close to the relational interpretation.
So a lot of this reminds me of facts about my toy theory and how you derive things. And it seems to me that the principle that really makes a big difference is this idea that you can't have knowledge of logical connectives of complementary variables. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so for me, the most interesting thing is that you can actually derive the particular, you know, Bell inequality violating correlations as opposed to the ones that appear in the toy theory for two qubits. And I don't know of many principles that can do that. So I'm thinking about that in the context of a single qubit, and I'll just mention something that sort of points in the opposite direction, sort of a tension with this notion. So for in the toy theory, for a single system, elementary system, you can know position, that's a binary position, you can know binary momentum, or the third thing you can know, the third question, is a parity of position and momentum. So there it clearly violates your assumption in the sense that, okay, that's a logical connective of complementary things, and we can know it according to that theory. And so in your approach, the Q3 for a single system really has to be thought of as not a function of Q1 and Q2, but its own independent degree of freedom.
Yeah.
And there's various things about quantum theory that suggest to me that that's not right. So let me just give you one example.
Okay, go
ahead.
What I would say is, so I don't really make a statement. So I would say it's more correct to say that I don't have to make a statement about whether the third one is really an independent one or not. So
because that would be knowing.
So I mean, I'm basically only talking about information that the observer has access to.
Right.
So, but of course, that doesn't preclude that in principle, if you had some hidden variable model for it, you could, you know, represent the same thing by having that it turns out in that model you get a that the third question is somehow a correlation of the first two at an ontic level. You could in principle do that. It's just that here, from this perspective, it's not necessary to talk about that.
I had the impression that it wasn't. Just that it wasn't necessary to think of Q3 as a logical function of Q1 and Q2, but that you cannot think of it that way because if you did, it would violate one of your assumptions.
I mean, so at an epistemic level, it is not. So it's impossible to say that it is, yes.
Okay. So I'm not saying this is wrong. I mean, I think it's really interesting and it gets close to quantum theory, but I just sort of want to explore that idea and tell you about some things that are kind of in tension with it. So something that always struck me. So in the toy theory approach, you know, Q3 is a function of Q1 and Q2. It's just Q1 and Q2 are like position momentum, and Q3 is like parity.
Yeah.
And then if I look at quantum theory and I say, I can't measure Z spin, Y spin, and X spin simultaneously, so there's sort of no sense which I can directly probe whether I could infer, say, the Y spin from knowledge of the X and Z spin, so I can't access it that way. But is there any other sort of indirect evidence that maybe Y isn't independent of X and Z? And it strikes me that there is. So for example, if you ask, if Y were a function of X and Z, then you'd think that any transformation, any channel that preserves X spin and Z spin would also have to preserve Y, because Y is a function of X and Z. So then you ask, and you say, are there any CP maps that preserve X spin and Z spin, but, you know, decohere Y or do something different to Y? No. If you preserve X spin and Z spin, you necessarily preserve Y spin as well. So this is just sort of like one example of something that, to my mind, kind of suggested that this idea that Y spin's a function of X spin, Z spin is correct. And your approach deviates from that. And so I just point that out as something that maybe it would be interesting to explore in your approach, because you would have to have a different kind of intuition for why there are no channels that preserve X and Z but not Y. I mean, it'll have to come out because you've derived qubit quantum theory. But I'm sort of curious how you would think of that fact in your approach.
Definitely something I haven't thought about. I guess at this moment I don't really have a good answer to that. I mean, it's something we should discuss. I guess at the moment I'm not able to give you a good answer on this. I don't know. yeah, we can discuss that.
Yeah. What you're finding is basically that at the operator level, Z is a function of S. That's really what this is coming from.
That's, mathematically.
Mathematically speaking, you compute X and Y.
The reason there are no channels that in the block sphere kind of look like a pancake, they map the block sphere to a pancake, is precisely because they preserve algebras, and if they preserve X and Z, then they'll preserve Y as well.
Yeah, but I mean, you see, so, I mean, but here you would get the same if that's true in quantum theory. I mean, it's true here because you got quantum theory.
But
I mean, the thing is, I think the statement for me is really, I mean, because I'm only doing epistemic statements for the observer, it would not be literally possible to verify that, you know, Y is a function of X and Z, but okay, I don't know if.
This is what you're saying.
And your question is the operator, not only the state space, but the operator algebra, so in some sense encoded in all of these? I mean, is there a more direct route to the operator algebra than first constructing the state space and saying that now we just look at all the bounded operators on the state space?
Maybe I should put it this way, that I have certain intuitions about why certain facts about quantum theory are true. So why are there no pancake maps in the block sphere? My intuition is, oh, that's because so the pancake map would be, it takes the block sphere to, say, the XZ plane.
So to a disk, basically.
What's that?
To a disk, then.
Yeah, like a qubit to a rebit.
Yeah.
That is not a CP map.
Yeah.
And that's why I say if you preserve X and Z, you preserve Y as well.
Mm-hmm.
So think of that as the no pancake theorem. So anyways, the intuition is that, it's because Y is not an independent degree of freedom from X and Z. It's just a function of the two in some sense. And so I'm kind of intrigued by your approach. And I guess what I'm wondering is, how do I replace all those old intuitions with new intuitions? You know, like, according to this approach, that's just as fundamentally wrong. Y is not a function of X and Z. It goes against the basic assumption of this framework. So I have to, you know, rethink the no pancake theorem in a new way. And I kind of want to hear what that new intuition should look like. And I have a few other examples like this that
interesting. I mean, you might not have to go all the way through the derivation of all quantum theory and then just prove it as a fact about CP maps. So one thing wrong with the pancake map is, you know, if you do it on a Bell state, you end up with something that's not an announced state.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe one could go through some of these sorts of arguments and see that the thing you end up with sort of violates some of the assumptions we had at early stages to do with the structure of the sets of observables. So it might sort of emerge at a sort of relatively early stage of what was happening here, rather than just have to do the whole derivation. So.
I'm afraid I can't satisfy your.
No, it's okay.
At this very moment, that's something I would have to think about. But,
You might have answered this before, but. You said that the information is the length of the vector. Which notion of information is this?
Well, that's the information that the observer has about the system. But by the length of the vector? No, I mean, basically, there are a few things that go into it, but... sorry? No, it's not a definite... No, it's not. You derive it.
So what's the definition?
What's the definition? I make an assumption on. So the definition is, so I start from the start here by making an assumption about how I want to quantify the information of the observer about a system, so that the information that the observer has about a certain question, I want to be a function of only the probability associated to that question, and that's supposed to be a function that gives you between 0 and 1 bit. So, and then I quantify the total information of the observer about the system as being the sum of all the information he has about an informationally complete set of questions. But at this stage, I don't really make any assumption about what this alpha is. But then there's this postulate here. One condition is now that the time evolution group has to to preserve that condition. So that's one thing. And that, and then the time evolution has to be continuous. And then you can, in fact, in the end, make some operational, operational arguments combined with continuity of time evolution that and preservation of the total information that singles out then the square norm. So basically, the square norm is the only norm that. You make some operational arguments that lead to the information measure being some power of the Bloch vector component. You get that. So then you get basically that the information of the containing the total state is the P norm of that state, and then it turns out the only P norm that is preserved under a continuous group is the two norm, and then you get.
The trace row log row.
If you take the von Neumann measure, I guess that's conceptually closer to the Shannon entropy. So this here is not the Shannon entropy.
No, it's not. So is there anything? Any other? Is this a new definition of entropy?
That's a new measure. I mean, it has been proposed before from a different perspective by Buchner and Zeilinger. Basically, they argued that the Shannon entropy is not good for quantum theory, that one should instead use the square measure. But here I derive it from principles.
Does it work in thermodynamics?
That's a question that I asked myself, and I don't know. I mean, so there have been a number of papers that were written on this measure after Buchner and Zeilinger proposed it. But I'm not sure if any of them considered a thermodynamic context. So I don't actually know. Here in this context, the square norm turns out to be absolutely crucial in the derivation. But yeah, so and it clearly is different from the Shannon entropy.
So I wonder if there's any connection with symplectic structure, because in these toy theories, all these complementary questions have to do with symplectic structure. And I thought that maybe on one of your when you were talking about the group of transformations for two qubits, were there some symplectic groups on that slide or no?
I'm not aware of it. So you mean this here or this? It's no symplectic group. It's SU4,
okay, no.
SO6, and PSU4.
It's symplectic structure of the two spheres, or the symplectic structure, are you thinking?
Well, you can reformulate the toy theory in two ways. One is in terms of kind of the same sort of logical knowing the answers to a bunch of questions, but you can also talk about a kind of discrete symplectic structure, and you can say things like questions are complementary if they are questions about the values of variables that are canonically conjugate with respect to the underlying symplectic structure. So I'm kind of wondering, this whole structure of complementarity and compatibility you've derived sort of is reminiscent of the notion of canonical conjugacy. And yeah, I just wonder.
I'm afraid that's another point to which I don't have a good answer.
I bet there's something there.
I remember that you, I think you once explained me how to do this discrete symplectic structure for your toy theory, but that also required some ontic statements, right? So I wouldn't see how you could do that here without at the purely epistemic level. I wouldn't know how to do that.
Well, I think the ontic versus epistemic is not a big deal, because even if I look at, say, the qubit stabilizer formalism, so there's no good ontological model for that, that's non-contextual and so forth, I can still have a representation of the symplectic group on that, so I can find vial operators and a kind of representation of symplectic affine group on that guy. And so I would guess that your complementarity structure would have something to do with canonical conjugacy relative to that representation.
If you can do this in quantum theory, then you can do it here, because the complementarity relations that you get for the questions, they are exactly quantum theory. I mean, the questions that I have in the end, they correspond literally to projective measurements on Pauli operators, and if the questions are complementary, then it means the corresponding Pauli operators do not commute, for instance.
Yeah.
And so if you can do it in quantum theory, then that would, if it is related in quantum theory to the complementarity structure there, then you can definitely do this here as well.
So the opportunity, I'm thinking, is that you might be able to say something very abstract but succinct about your complementarity structures that you derive. You could say, you know, they correspond to a representation of a symplectic group or something like that. So it might just be a nice kind of intermediate target towards getting to quantum theory. It's a nice way of saying what you derive.
Okay.
But I don't know exactly what that would be.
Yeah. So, but you know, kind of principle, for instance, when it comes to, if you're only interested in coding when, you know, these questions here are complementary or compatible, there's a very brief way in which you can phrase it. So it's, for instance, two such questions. Q, Y1 to Yn, and nu1 to nu n, so they are compatible if they disagree on an even number of non-zero indices, and they are complementary if they disagree on an odd number of non-zero indices. So you can show that. So if you're only interested in making it very succinct, then you can do it this way.
Still, I like what you're saying. It seems like it agrees with what Raphael is saying. If you take a spin a half particle, you can put a, if you think of it as a classical spin, an angular momentum, you can put a symplectic structure on the sphere. And it should be that that symplectic structure is related to the Bloch sphere.
And that the symplectic structure I had in mind was rather different because it was on a phase space over a finite field. So it was like, per qubit, it's like the phase space is Z2 cross Z2. I think that's different from the symplectic structure that you're thinking of like Bloch sphere, which is a whole continuous manifold. So I don't have any intuitions about what the connection with this other symplectic structure would be. But given the discreteness of this question structure, it's more plausible that you can map onto the discrete.
For a particular basis of your questions, that should be, for a given information complete set.
You mean your symplectic structure is like a two-form in this vector space, in this finite vector space? I mean, the
vector space over a finite field, yeah.
Yeah, which is finite, right.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, I don't know.
So this is a thing not conventionally studied by physicists, those kinds of things. So.
Not that I know. No.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I think it's an interesting. Just go back to a question I asked before, but maybe you can answer more in detail. How much? It's an interesting question. How far you can get without needing to invoke probabilities? That's in a sense. That's almost the. It seems to me that's in a sense the underlying.
Almost
what you have in mind when you start, even though.
Yes, I mean, that was actually...
And in the end, you had to use them. So,
my motivation was also to... Okay, so I mean, the GPT framework is very much based on the probabilistic structure. And so one question was, how far can you get away from it? But ultimately here, although what I'm discussing is not... I mean, part of it is not so much focused on the probabilistic structure. It's always implicitly contained in it. Because even when I talk about... When I talk about the notion of questions being independent or compatible, then I mean I define them using probabilities. So I define them using state spaces, and I guess you were not here when I did this.
So your fundamental notions all involve probability at some level.
Yeah. So then, once I have this defined, the notion of independence, compatibility, and complementarity, which I define in terms of state spaces, then I can go on and work without probabilities, but they're implicitly contained in a class.
So this is another place where that symplectic structure would be nice, that you would be able to remove any reference to probability from that complementarity hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I must admit that talking about probabilities and frequencies of occurrences of outcomes is operationally more clear than thinking about an abstract symplectic structure. So that's why I like this approach.
It might be that this sort of logical approach could be a way of describing what symplectic structure is.
Yeah.
So you can sort of undergird talk about symplectic structure with
different thoughts to it in this context. Yeah. That would be, to me, a nice
result
starting
nice.
Directly with the
yeah.
symplectic structure.
Your answer to my question about the definition of independence, I think I understood and I didn't want to slow you down, but let me just make sure I got it right. So if we do a sequence of two measurements. And I should think about the first measurements as having the following property, that if, you know, if I'm asking QI in the first measurement and then QJ in the second, then I'm asking the QI measurement, like, you know, quantum mechanically I'd be doing it in the von Neumann way where sort of, you know, it's reproducible. And so I'm thinking of it that I can abstractly define it as I ask that question in such a way that were I to ask it a second time on the system,
yeah, yeah.
I would get the same answer. And that's the sense in which I'm asking these things in the von Neumann way.
Probably that's contained in this implicitly.
So something like, you know, mm-hmm. you asked QI in the reproducible way of asking QI, and then you follow that up with the QJ measurement.
So basically, actually, one could maybe also write this here as a conditional probability that first I've gotten QI equals yes, say, and then QJ equals yes, that gives you, that this factorizes that probability. But I write it in this way because I want it to be symmetric.
All I'm emphasizing is that there's kind of a caveat that hasn't been made totally explicit here, which is that this is not true for every way of measuring QI, but just these very particular ways of measuring QI. In a quantum information context,
yeah.
we typically think of von Neumann measurements as an extremely special case, and most update rules don't look like the von Neumann one.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to kind of explicitly point out that you're using a projection postulate update map. And so it seems to me you have to do something here and add in that caveat.
So I mean, so implicitly I'm kind of thinking about the measurement in that way, yes.
Yeah.
So I mean, here it's really many of the things they, I mean, also, of course, the questions that I get are not, don't correspond to arbitrary observables, but it's only a subset of the possible observables. And okay, they correspond, of course, to projective measurements of that subset of observables and not to POVMs and so on. So it's, of course, it's not full generality here that I have of quantum theory, but yeah. Was for me, it's more of a proof of principle that you can do it in this way. But of course, I'm open to the possibility that you can generalize many of these ideas or streamline them.
If the way you ask QI is repeatable, then doesn't independence follow from complementarity?
Yes, I mean, complementary questions are by construction then also independent, but independent questions are not necessarily complementary.
Like a measurement on system one and measurement on system two.
So I mean, yeah, so for a single qubit, all independent questions are complementary, but if I have two qubits, then I can have spin of qubit one in x direction and spin of qubit two in x direction, they will be independent but compatible.
Okay, there's nothing else. Thank you, Philip, again.
All right.